is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Professor Paul Halpern at the University of the Sciences, the author of a new book, Flashes of Creation, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and the Great Big Bang Debate of the 20th Century. Professor, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. Let's get our two protagonists born. Georgi Antonovich Gamow, born Odessa, March of 1904. I find most ironic his father was a teacher. This was the time that there was much excitement in Russia because of the revolution, 1905, and then the 1917-1918 revolution. But his father, who was one of his father's students, and what did our hero, Georgi Antonovich Gamow, make of that fact? Good evening to you, Paul.
Good evening. Thank you for having me on the show. It's spelled Geo and pronounced Joe Gamow. That he always went by the American nickname Joe, interestingly enough, or you could say George. His father was Anton Gamow, who was a very bright school teacher, and his student was Lev Bronstein, better known as Leon Trotsky, the Russian revolutionary, a future Russian revolutionary. And interestingly, the young Trotsky tried to institute a kind of coup in Anton's classroom. He thought that Anton was an unfair teacher and circulated a petition and had every student sign one letter of the petition to emphasize the fact that everybody was united against the teacher. And they circulated it to the headmaster of the school. But luckily for the Gamows, Anton was not fired, so the coup d'etat failed.
This is the early part of the 20th century, and what we're talking about is revolution, but not revolution politically, revolution in physics and cosmology. Gamow, our hero, is born now, and we leave him because his education will include the lucky step to go to the University of, one time, St. Petersburg, later Petrograd, later Leningrad, now again St. Petersburg in Russia. We need to turn to Fred Hoyle, born 1915, 11 years younger, January, in West Yorkshire. His mother and father also significant in his life, especially my reading, Paul. His mother, a pianist, a very good pianist. What did the young explorer learn from his mother that he used later in life, Paul?
Well, we'll find that our protagonists are very cinematic. And Hoyle loved the cinema, and that's because his mother had a job at the cinema for silent films. She would play the background music for the films, and these films would be sort of corny westerns or early love stories and so forth, kind of kitschy films. And instead of playing the kitschy music that went along with the films, she would play beautiful classical music. And one point she was fired because they found out she was playing the wrong music. But then they realized that people were going to the cinema to hear her play the music, not to see the films. So she was reinstated. And young Fred used to sit in the audience and watch the subtitles of the films. And that's how he learned how to read.
Wonderful to have these two stories, because both men, Gamow and Hoyle, are storytellers. That's their genius, to transfer their knowledge of physics and cosmology to a popular public at the same time, to make it available to all of us to understand where we are in the 21st century with cosmology and physics. It all is connected. We now go to the education of Gamow. His father sells some of the family's silver. I always thought that was an apocryphal story, Paul, but here it is. To send the young Joe, off to Petrograd University, where he's fortunate to have one of his inspirational teachers, Alexander Friedman. Who was he, Paul?
So Friedman was a trained meteorologist, and he was very interested in mapping out high altitude weather and went up in balloons to explore these measurements. But he also turned to cosmology because in 1915, the year that Fred Hoyle was born, coincidentally, that's when Albert Einstein released his general theory of relativity, and that had some solutions which were intended to describe the universe. And Friedman decided to take a crack at that, and he developed his own solutions of Einstein's theory of general relativity that expand in some ways, ironically, like a balloon. So he imagined the universe blowing up like a balloon with all the dots. Let's say you painted dots on the side of the balloon, getting more and more separate over time. And in one of his models, the balloon keeps expanding forever. In another model, the balloon deflates. Now, unfortunately, Friedman came up with a theory in 1922, really enticed Gamow, because Gamow took a course in general relativity with Friedman. But then several years later, Friedman went up in a balloon, caught cold, and then, I don't know if this is related, but sometime later, he got typhoid and died at a young age.
Yes, it's a playwright in the sky, Paul, that gives us the balloon theory of the universe, which isn't bad, with a balloonist exit for our inspiration, Professor Friedman. However, at the same time, we have to watch the fact that Gamow was fortunate in his progress from Friedman's inspiration to other voices, including Einstein's, who was often in the news and often in cosmology and also in physics. Did Gamow make a decision at this point that he was going to pursue special relativity and general relativity? Did he find himself absorbed by that community?
Well, when Gamow took Friedman's course, he wanted to pursue those fields. But then because of Friedman's death, he had to switch to quantum physics, which led him eventually to nuclear physics. And we're fortunate, science is fortunate, that Gamow switched fields briefly because he made major inroads in nuclear physics. He discovered the process of the mathematical process of how alpha particles can decay, which is a radiative process. He understood how something called quantum tunneling can enable particles that are of opposite charge, like protons, to get together and overcome the energy barriers between them. And today we know that that's the fusion process that fuels the stars. And then his theory was also used to understand how to make particle colliders, accelerators that collide into fixed targets and later into moving targets.
There are theories floating around in the air right now, and Gamow has our interlocutor with those theories. But I want to follow his adventures as a young Russian, a Russian revolutionary product, because by this time in the 1920s, Leningrad and Moscow are dominated by paratchiks and commissars. And of course, with Lenin's death, we pass on to Stalin and the Central Committee. But that doesn't prevent Gamow from winning permission to go to the Niels Bohr, well, first to Göttingen for an exercise in wave function and a lot of discovery that gives him his PhD at Leningrad. But then he goes to Niels Bohr's Institute in Copenhagen. And you have a wonderful picture in your book of Niels Bohr's Institute in the snow. So I imagined Gamow traipsing through the light snow each day with his motorcycle. Did he ride his motorcycle in the snow? Because you make much of the fact that he was daring.
I'm not sure if he would ride in the deep snow, but he rode his motorcycle everywhere. He loved his motorcycle and rode it all around Europe. And Niels Bohr borrowed it at least once, and other people borrowed it. He taught people how to use a motorcycle. So that was one of his trademarks. His other trademark at the Niels Bohr Institute was his cartooning. He had some language issues in the beginning because they were speaking Danish, English, and German, and he didn't know any of those languages to start with. So he could draw sketches and make people laugh through his sketches.
The events in Copenhagen followed by geopolitics crowding in on us, Paul, because he will be obliged or felt it necessary to return to the Soviet Union, where increasingly he was circumscribed. I'll go quickly here. But he meets a young woman and falls in love and sees that he needs to escape. I love the moment where they're on the Black Sea trying to escape in a rubber boat. I thought that was terrific staging on Paul's part. I mean, on Gamow's part, because I thought they were going to die. But they didn't. They eventually find a way to the West by attending a conference. Did he, in his mind, reject the communists? Was he a political writer as well as a person who wrote physics?
Gamow was generally apolitical and non-religious. He didn't like controversy. But at the same time, he didn't like the communist regime precisely because it was so political. And once it started to intrude into science and started to argue that science should be interpreted through Marxist-Leninist philosophy, that was the line in the sand. Gamov couldn't see doing any scientific work if it's going to be proscribed by following certain political beliefs. And that's when he knew that he had to escape from the Soviet Union, and he knew that he had to bring his young wife with him. So they tried the rubber kayak in the Black Sea. They were going to go to Turkey and pretend that they were Danish and go to the Danish embassy and have Niels Bohr bail them out. But they barely made it across the sea. They went out for one day, and the next day was stormy. They were blown back to shore. So that was it for that plan. But luckily, Niels Bohr arranged that he was the Soviet representative to the Salve Conference of 1933. And he worked very hard. Gamov worked very hard to get his wife to be able to go along with him so that they could escape.
They eventually do escape all the way to George Washington University. But we need to turn to Fred, who's 11 years younger. And these two competing thinkers of the 20th century about the origins and the sustaining of the universe will meet eventually, but right now they're living parallel lives in cosmology and physics. The book is Flashes of Creation, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and the Great Big Bang Debate. Paul Halpern is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Paul Halpern. His new book is Flashes of Creation, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and the Great Big Bang Debate. I met Fred Hoyle from a science fiction book he wrote in the 1950s. I met George Gamow from a book that he wrote about cosmology, 1, 2, 3, Infinity, in the 1950s. I never understood Gamow. I loved Hoyle. So those are my prejudices, but to have them both together is a joy, thanks to Paul's work. So we pick up our story of the son of the pianist at the movies, Fred Hoyle. He arrives at Cambridge through a series of you-can't-make-this-up debates. He has mentor professors, and he's guided to Cambridge. He arrives at the time of a rich turning of physics at Cambridge. Max Born, Rudolf Pirls, they're building an accelerator. The professor de Sitter dies, but others come, Professor Price, Professor Dirac. And he wins his PhD eventually in 1939. What did Fred Hoyle think he was while at Cambridge with all these distinguished physicists, Paul?
He definitely wanted to be a particle physicist or a nuclear physicist. Originally, in high school, he wanted to be a chemist. And as a child, he loved astronomy, but he went from astronomy to chemistry. And finally, at Cambridge, he imagined himself working in particle labs and interpreting the information, so interpreting the data. Very, very similar to what Gamow was doing sometime earlier. So Gamow would develop models of how nuclear particles interacted. Hoyle had a great respect for Gamow's work. I wanted to kind of continue along those lines. And then, of course, in 1939, World War II came along, and Hoyle had to, he got his PhD, but then he had to wait until he could get a professorship at Cambridge, which didn't come until 1945.
He plunges into super secret work, which is radar. He eventually joins in 42 Section 8X. RC8. I love these titles. It has no meaning, Paul, but it's wonderfully romantic. And he's attracted to astronomy. Astronomy of population 1 and population 2 stars. I think about this time he buys himself a telescope. What did he make of astronomy and particle physics? Did he think of them as two ends of the same story?
Well, what happened was he went to the United States for a meeting related to military-related issues. And he was interested in talking to astronomers in the United States. That was a fascination. So he decided to speak to somebody named Walter Bade. And Walter Bade had a remarkable theory about supernova explosions being the end results of older stars very hydrogen-rich stars, very massive stars that meet a catastrophic end and end up in an explosion. And the idea was, from Walter Bade, that there was an earlier generation of stars called Population 2. They exploded in supernova, and their material was distributed around the galaxy, around the universe, and that material was picked up by the more recent stars, such as the Sun, and which is why the Sun has a lot of other materials in it. And Hoyle thought that was fascinating and developed in 1946 a key paper on stellar nucleosynthesis, trying to explain how all the higher elements are produced step by step, starting with hydrogen all the way up to uranium. And that he sketched the idea in 1946. He further developed it in the 50s with other researchers. And this idea became the basis of the origin of the chemical elements.
We're looking at two large theories that have been developing while we're racing through the education of our protagonists. Because telescopes were still discerning the differences between fuzzy stars and near stars, and there was not certainty that the universe was made up of many galaxies as opposed to the one, the Milky Way. This is developing in these same years. So astronomy is getting more articulate as physics is getting more articulate. Just a note here, we have a couple of minutes. And Paul, the reason you're good at this is because you can do in 2 minutes the steady state versus the cosmic egg. Lemaître, a French priest, I believe, comes up with the idea of what we understand to be the Big Bang, the original moment. He calls it the cosmic egg. That is a competing source with steady state, which is it true that Einstein was an early steady state, early fixed universe thinker that later who later changed?
He wrote one paper that was never published on the steady state idea. And a friend of mine, an Irish physicist, Cormac Rafferty, discovered that the paper was an early version of the steady state theory, but it was never published, so Einstein discarded the idea.
Right. Einstein discarded steady state, but Hoyle takes it up. Gamow, was he either or? Did he go with Lemaître's cosmic egg, or did he go with steady state, or did he wait?
Gamow was firmly in the Big Bang camp. He further developed the idea of Lemaître and Friedman. So Friedman talked about an expanding universe. Lemaître also talked about expanding universe, added the part about the primeval atom, and then that became what's now known as the Big Bang theory. And Gamow said, well, that theory could be used to explain how all the elements come about. So Gamow had a competing theory of the elements, which said that all the elements were produced in the hot early universe during the Big Bang.
Yes, there are some difficulties here. One, they did not have a good estimate of the age of the cosmos that we now understand as 13.4 or 13.8, Paul? I can never remember the difference. 13.8 billion years. They were dealing with numbers anywhere between 2 billion and 10 billion. But we'll turn to that controversy. The book is Flashes of Creation, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and the Great Big Bang Debate. Paul Halpern is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Professor Paul Halpern, professor of physics at the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia. His new book is Flashes of Creation, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and the Great Big Bang Debate. We are now after the Second War. And our two protagonists, Fred Hoyle at Cambridge and George Gamow at George Washington University, are looking at the big topics of the moment, which is cosmology, but particle physics combined with cosmology. And 46, 47, 48 are critical moments in the development of these competing or parallel theories. There is a wonderful moment, however. It is either 46 or 47. Our hero, Professor Hoyle, and two of his colleagues at Cambridge, Bondi and Gold, watch a movie called The Dead of Night. It is a horror movie, a scary movie that ends with a beginning and begins with an ending. It's looped. A dream that becomes a nightmare that becomes a fact. And at the end of this, they have a breakthrough. What is it, Paul?
So after seeing this movie, which is which has a twist ending where the nightmare is repeated again and again, they went back to Bondi's apartment in Cambridge, had a few drinks, and over drinks, Tommy Gold said, well, what if the universe is like that? So they thought about it and they said, well, maybe we can design a model of the universe that even though it expands, new matter fills in the gaps. So it pretty much looks the same forever. So as the galaxies move apart from each other, then new matter slowly trickles in. That matter clusters, eventually forms stars, and finally forms galaxies. So I like to think of the difference between the Big Bang and the steady state as having to do with stadium seating. So imagine, let's say, Yankee Stadium, people are watching a ball game, and then suddenly there's an announcement on a loudspeaker that you need to move back and you need to leave at least one row in between you and the person in front of you and the person in back of you. So people start moving back and the people would expand and fill a greater and greater part of the stadium, and there'd be gaps, row gaps between the seats. Well, that's the Big Bang theory. In the steady state theory, imagine that some young people want to take advantage of this to sit closer in the stadium, and they manage to sneak in and fill in all the empty rows slowly. So then it would look exactly the same. You'd still have filled in rows, and new people would fill in the gaps where the old people left. So that would be the steady state theory.
Yes, I think Fred Hoare calls it continuous creation. And continuous creation requires the nuclear physics to create. And that is going to be Fred Hoyle's genius. That's where he's following. In order to come up with a steady state, you've got to create matter or energy or both. So let's pursue that. How does Fred Hoare, Professor Hoare, imagine these little creations happen? Where do they happen? And it takes us into stars. They had a problem at this point, I believe. The sun, our sun, isn't hot enough to create the elements necessary to imagine the rest of the universe. What does Professor Hoare do to solve that problem, Paul?
Okay, well, here there are two different problems that are related to each other. One is, how does the original matter in the universe come about? And he used the idea of quantum uncertainty, the idea that if you take a small enough region of space, because of the uncertainty principle, it's possible for new particles to emerge from empty space spontaneously. So that is actually a well-known phenomena. It's that the vacuum can produce particles. And he called that the creation field. So the creation field would bring new particles into birth. The question about the sun and how stars can produce heavier elements is also a very interesting one. And that has to do with the fact that there's a gap in the ladder of element creation. So if you start with hydrogen, it's pretty easy to make helium. You can make it in the Big Bang. You can make it in the sun. Helium is made everywhere. But then if you want to bring helium together to form carbon, there's a big problem. And we need carbon for life, Hoare recognized. Without carbon, there's no life. And the way to make carbon, he discovered, is you take two helium elements in a very, very hot situation, and the two helium atoms fuse. They form beryllium-8, which almost immediately decays. But in that brief moment, there's a quantum process which enables that to unite with another helium atom. And then they forge together, and they form a special state of carbon, which is stable. And that's a state of carbon-12. And Hoare did the calculations, and he predicted there's going to be a type of carbon with a certain energy level. And he went to Caltech, said to Willie Fowler, see if you can find this state to prove my theory. And that turned out to be absolutely correct. And the way to get to heat, by the way, is to have dying stars. That's what Hoare recognizes in his genius. Stars that are at their end point, end of their lifetime, their cores collapse catastrophically. They shrink down and they heat up immensely. So they're much hotter than the cores of the sun.
It is one of the ironies of science history that it is Fred Hoyle on a radio show who invents the term Big Bang that we all love. That is not embraced by Gamow and those people who follow the Big Bang. Gamow thinks of it as the big squeeze. How does he explain the original creation moment, Paul?
Well, Gamow, and working with his student Ralph Alpher, he calls the initial substance of the universe LEM, which is spelled Y-L-E-M, which is an ancient Latin term for matter. I should say medieval Latin term for matter. And they imagined that there was this giant cluster of matter. They didn't know what it was, but somehow it broke up into neutrons in the early universe. And then these neutrons could individually get together through fusion processes and start to form some of the elements, starting with heavy hydrogen and so forth. And neutrons can decay into protons, so that's where you get ordinary hydrogen. So that was the idea behind the process. He never liked the term Big Bang because he said the early universe was neither big and it wasn't an explosion. But Hoyle coined the term on BBC radio as kind of a derisive term. He wanted to make fun of the idea that everything would be created in one blast. He thought it was much more credible to think of things being created slowly over time.
We make a note here because Paul pays attention to the fact that the religious or anti-religious thinking of all of these men and women weigh on the metaphors. For example, those who accept the fact that the universe has a finite age versus those who want oscillation or repetition. It comes in and it goes away. It's always floating around, however, for their choice of metaphors. We come now to a wonderful meeting of these two heroes, protagonists. It is 1956. Do I have that right, Paul? Yes, 1956.
Yes. Summer 56.
Summer 56. They're both out west, one at Caltech, the other at the University of Colorado Boulder, where Gamow has moved after he separates and divorces his first wife and moves to the University of Colorado at Boulder. And they're driving in a Cadillac, a white Cadillac, Paul. Is that right, Paul, a white Cadillac?
Well, just to add something, that summer, Gamow had a temporary job. He wasn't in Colorado. He was in La Jolla.
Oh, thank you.
Working for a defense company as a consultant.
And he had some money in his pocket, so that's why
Cadillac. That's right. So you got the white Cadillac.
So they're driving around together. And are they debating? Are they laughing? How do you imagine their conversation, Paul?
Well, Hoyle and Gamow were both very affable people, and they got along very well with almost everybody else. In fact, in my book, I also mention a subsequent ride that Hoyle took with LaMatra, riding through Europe. So Hoyle loved to kind of ride around and discuss ideas. And he was fine with debating as long as people were open-minded. He didn't like people who were closed-minded, and he didn't like people who were snooty. If somebody tried to pull rank or class on him, he was very upset because he was from a working-class family. But other than that, if people were down-to-earth, he loved debating with them. So in this white Cadillac, as they were driving around La Jolla, they were talking about the temperature of the universe. And Hoyle thought that the overall temperature of the universe should be close to 0 degrees Kelvin, which is above absolute zero. So almost as close to absolute zero as you can get. And Gamow at that time, he had gone back and forth on temperature, but apparently he was interested in a temperature of about 10 degrees above absolute zero. And later Hoyle regretted that they didn't split the difference and make a prediction about the temperature of the universe because that was something that was found in 1964.
Oh, let's get to it. This is the accidental revelation of physics that create the opportunity, word create is wrong, that guide us for where we are today. They're the two men, Penzias, who gets his PhD in 61, and he's from Europe, and Wilson from Houston, are working for Bell Labs outside of Princeton University. And they're originally there about communication. Quasar, the first communication satellites. But then they have an idea that they're going to find the halo of our galaxy. And they can't find it. It probably doesn't exist. I don't want to say doesn't, because that's a conclusion in physics. However, they do find a hiss that is in all directions. What is it, Paul?
Well, they were perplexed because they aimed their radio telescope in all different directions and they had a persistent hiss. And first they tried to rule out noise from the city. Bell Labs is pretty close to New York City. And they subtracted that background noise. They wanted to see if there was any noise in the area, any construction work. And finally, they decided to rule out the idea that pigeon droppings, which they called white dielectric material deposited on the antenna, was the cause of the hiss. So they went outside and cleaned up all the pigeon droppings and trapped all the pigeons in cages. And those cages are now, one of them is in the Smithsonian Institute on display. And once they did that, they still got the hiss. And then coincidentally, Penzias knew someone who knew someone who went to a lecture by Jim Peebles, who was working with Robert Dickey in Princeton. And Peebles was talking about the project that Robert Dickey had to try to detect radiation from the early universe. And Penzias was like, wow, that sounds related to what we're doing. So he called up Dickey and talked about the hiss. And Dickey was there in a brown bag lunch meeting with his associates and students, including Peebles. And he was talking for a while, and then he hung up the phone and said, boys, we've been scooped, meaning that they found the hiss first, accidentally, which is a hiss they were looking for. Dickey was trying to look for the hiss. Actually, they prove a different theory, that the universe was oscillating. He had his own theory that the universe had previous stages. He wasn't looking for the Big Bang hiss, but it turned out to be proof of the Big Bang.
Yes, it's the Big Bang. In other words, what we have now is Gamow vindicated and Hoyle challenged. So when we come back, the later years of our two protagonists, the book is Flashes of Creation, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and the Great Big Bang Debate. Paul Halpern is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Paul Halpern. His new book is Flashes of Creation, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and the Great Big Bang Debate. We've now found evidence of the Big Bang, or the Big Squeeze, or the creation moment. We also have better and better understanding of how long ago it happened, 13.8. The temperature of the cosmos turns out to be, I believe, 3 degrees Kelvin. Is that correct, Paul? 3?
Yeah, more precisely about 2.73 degrees Kelvin, but 3 was about what they came up with at that time.
And we follow Gamow first because he's older and his health becomes a challenge to him in the 1960s. He will die in 1968. He's a smoker and he has troubles with alcohol. However, before he passes away, he recognizes that his work has contributed to these discoveries. Is that correct, Paul?
Oh, yes. He started writing to people. He wrote to Peebles. He wrote to Dickey. And his student, Ralph Alpher, also was writing continuously to them to try to get the record straight, because some of the calculations that were done by the Dickey and Peebles group essentially reproduced some of the work that Alpher, and under the tutelage of Gamow, had done in the 1940s. So they were trying to bring attention to their earlier papers. And at one point, Gamow went to a conference in New York, and at the conference, he made a statement: if you lose a penny and then you later find a penny, it's still the same penny. The same with my theories.
Yes, it's a wonderful metaphor. I liked him for it. Now, Fred Hoyle. Fred Hoyle works with husband and wife, Margaret and Jeffrey Burbridge, and Wilson Fowler. William Fowler, you've mentioned him earlier. You said that that Hoyle's work pursues into the bodies of stars. They come up with an explanation for elements heavier than iron. The puzzle here is not that they did it, it's genius work, but that later on, the Nobel Prize skips the Burbridges and Hoyle and gives the Nobel Prize for that work to Fowler only. We don't know why that's true. Is that correct, Paul, as of yet?
Yes, in my book, Flashes of Creation, I speculate as to why Hoyle was excluded from the Nobel Prize. And there are tons of theories about it. And all of Hoyle's former colleagues and his daughter and his son all weighed in on this. And they said that Hoyle was very upset, but he didn't really talk about it publicly. But he never talked to Willie Fowler, who was his good friend, again after that, and pretty much went off on his own. And some speculation is that his theories were becoming very fringe at the time in other areas. So the Nobel Committee wanted to stay away from him. But the leading theory is that one of the nominators, which is speculated to be Hans Bethe, thought that Fowler was the head of the group. And then he was later told, no, Hoyle was the one who came up with the idea. And Bethe was apologetic in talking to Jeff Burbage about this. So it's possible that it came down to one of the Nobel nominators having a misconception about Hoyle's role.
We'll know later when they open the papers. So right now, let's attend to the later years of our protagonist, Fred Hoyle. He and his wife moved to the Lake District, though Caltech wants them. She doesn't want to live in California, Barbara. They moved to the Lake District where he loves to hike. He has a wonderful conversation with the polymath Feynman. I said, all these conversations, Paul, are wonderful to imagine what they were thinking at the time, because they're now all legends, separate legends. I'm attracted to Fred Hoyle coming up with panspermia because that's current again, Paul, panspermia, the idea that life is spread throughout the universe by travelers like Oumuamua, the asteroid that just flashed through the solar system. Has anyone written about Fred Hoyle's early touching on panspermia besides you? Is that generally known now, Paul?
Well, there are several biographies of Hoyle, earlier biographies of Hoyle, but generally his panspermia era is not looked upon very favorably. But I found in researching my book and looking into it, I found that some contemporary people at Harvard were starting to talk about panspermia again. So I kind of treated it neutrally in my book. So I said that people thought at the time it was something on the fringes. I think the big thing that was controversial was not just the panspermia, not saying that life evolved elsewhere and came to the universe, but definitively saying that Darwinian evolution is impossible. Now, Hoyle started saying that the Earth is too young for evolution to have taken place, and that won him the admiration of young Earth creationists, who started to write to him and say, well, why don't you come to our conferences and give talks, which is ironic because Hoyle was more or less a religious, more or less an atheist, but he was invited to creationist conferences. And he didn't, I don't know if he saw the irony there. And then he started saying that all diseases, even contemporary diseases, come from space. And he said that Legionnaire's disease was brought in by a comet. AIDS was brought in by a comet. And people just thought that that was kind of bonkers.
A last detail about Fred Hoyle. Gamow leaves us in 1968. Last detail about Fred Hoyle, to my reading of him, is that he was creative more than he was archival. And his approach was spontaneity. Does that challenge the general understanding of how you should be a physicist, Paul? We have about a minute.
Well, both Gamow and Hoyle were seat of the pants thinkers. They would come up with an idea in a flash, test it out, and they didn't have any patience for developing ideas over many, many years. Gamow would come up with many, many different ideas. Many of them would fail, but he'd pursue the best ones. And Hoyle was more stubborn about sticking to some of the strange ideas he had.
Paul Halpern. The book is Flashes of Creation, George Gamow, Fred Hoyle, and the Great Big Bang Debate. That continues. Paul Halpern of the University of Sciences. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.